All right. About 12 years ago, when I was about 2 years into my journey of addiction recovery and living back in the UK, I was sent an email by a local treatment centre about a free lecture that was going to be taking place in London and hosted by my next guest. The lecture was about Paul Sunderland's research into the phenomenon of why adopted people are significantly overrepresented in addiction counselling. And that lecture had a really profound impact on me, because for the first time I heard as an adopted person, adoption being spoken about as trauma. And as you might know, I wrote about in my book, I was adopted at 6 weeks old. And for years, people would tell me, no, you were too young to remember. There's no way it would have negatively impacted on you. And the result, actually, of that narrative was that it then sort of negated the trauma that I had experienced as a very, very small person, and how that had then kind of contributed to ongoing issues around abandonment and discontent and addiction and the behaviours that I'd gone into rehab to recover from. November, as you might know, marks Adoption Month all over the globe, and it's often a time where adoptive parents particularly celebrate and talk about how wonderful adoption is, and adoption agencies encourage people to adopt. But sadly, what is often missing from Adoption Month is people's willingness to listen to and to engage with the real experts on adoption, which actually is adoptees. What's also missing, I think, are conversations like the one I'm about to have with Paul Sunderland, which focus on what the legacy of adoption and relinquishment can look like. Paul says that unequivocally, adoption is trauma, and that breaking the original mother-baby bond creates a wound so deep that it actually feels life-threatening and catastrophic for the adoptee. And I think that conversations like this are important because they contribute to bringing down, I think, I hope, the heartbreaking statistics related to adoptees. For example, did you know that adoptees are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide? They are overrepresented in jail. They are overrepresented in psychiatric facilities and treatment centres. Let's find out more as we welcome Paul Sunderland to Weekend Breakfast.
Paul, welcome to Weekend Breakfast with Sarah Jane King. It is such a treat to have you. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. And as I explained in the introduction there, I happened to get invited to something about, 11, 12 years ago now. I was very early in recovery myself, and somebody sent me something from LifeWorks Community about adoption and addiction. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to go and see what all that's about. And as I said, it had a really profound and lasting impact on me. I'm fascinated to know from you how you came to develop an interest in this particular area of work.
Firstly, I mean, Sarah Jane, how exciting that you were there then, because actually I think that was the first time I had spoken formally outside of a clinical training session about this topic. And my interest in all of this happened rather by accident. I trained as an addictions counsellor in the 1980s. What we started to notice that adoptees were overrepresented in the hospital setting that I was working in, which was sort of treating primarily drug and alcohol addiction. But I don't think, embarrassingly, I don't think we really took much notice. It was just like, gosh, that's a bit interesting. But the thing that I really did notice was that the staff members, many of whom were addicts in recovery, who, you know, want to sort of give back what they've got and have retrained to be, you know, addiction counsellors and therapists. I noticed that we had 3 on the clinical team who were adopted. And it was like, this is a bit weird. Do you know, I don't think I've ever seen so many adoptees in a small group setting. Then later on, when I was working in private practice, I started noticing again that adoptees were coming along often with actually what we tend to call now love addiction, but relationship problems, often at the end of a relationship, desperate for me to pull a rabbit out of a hat and tell them how to get back into the relationship. And very often in taking a history from them, they would say at the end, by the way, I was adopted. And so this is interesting. We have to pay attention here. You know, certain groups are overrepresented in addiction treatment programs and recovery programs and seem to present the same sorts of issues. So that was the beginning of it. And then, of course, trying to listen carefully and understand what was going on and relating present difficulties to past difficulties and realizing how complicated these pre-verbal traumas are, because they are remembered but not recalled, and they tend to act out. And so for the adoptees with relational problems, they are presenting with this real hunger for attachment, no surprise, but at the same time, this contradictory fear of rejection. And it seemed as if the only place that they were comfortable was somewhere in between the two. They could neither be in nor not in a relationship and feel regulated.
It's absolutely fascinating and so much. No, I appreciate it, and so much I'm sort of nodding along to. I want you to explain things like pre-verbal trauma and pre-verbal wound in just a second. But for me, the reason that this is so key is I went into treatment, and I went into two treatment centres. I've been in endless therapy for the last 15 years that I've been in recovery. And so often, as you'll know, when you go into a rehab facility, you are asked to do a life story. And my life story starts with, at the age of 6 weeks old, I was given up for adoption. And none of my therapists, none of my counsellors ever zoned in on that, ever, ever, ever. And it was so interesting to me, which is why, for me, when I came out of treatment and 2 years later ended up in that theatre hall or at the library, at Kensington Library, and listened to you, and I thought, but why had nobody else mentioned this before? Why did nobody else see the significance of it before? And so I want to talk a little bit later on in our conversation about why what you're saying or how we can apply what you're saying to adoptees and to people who are in recovery and might not necessarily think, but hold on a minute, the adoption thing. I want to pick up on the adoption, the word adoption, because actually you say that to call it adoption really is denial. What we're really talking about primarily is relinquishment. And it's that relinquishment that is a trauma that leads to what you describe as a post-traumatic stress disorder in the adoptee. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. There's a Chinese proverb that says the beginning of wisdom is to call something by its proper name. And, you know, I think we have a problem with the word adoption. It's a cover-up. It makes everything sound jolly nice. And it gives the impression that sort of life began at that moment. And of course, what we know about the newborn infant is there's all sorts of memory and interaction in the third trimester. We know that there's lots of memory in the first few years of life before there's recall, because there's a difference between being able to recall something and remember something. So there's overwhelming evidence about that. And of course, also babies, you probably know this, up until the 1960s, were treated as if they didn't have feelings. Actually, when babies were operated on in hospitals in the UK, at the beginning of the 60s, there was no anaesthesia because the belief was that babies don't have feelings. There was also a bit of a terror about administering anaesthesia to a very small animal, because actually, if you get the proportions wrong, something could go very wrong. The belief was, so all sorts of extraordinary beliefs about the life of the unborn and the newborn.
I want us to talk, you will talk, about the impact of breaking the original mother-baby bond. And the reason that I want to talk about that is this. It's that time of the year, it's adoption month all around the world. Social media is filled with adoptees like me, very often kind of saying, listen here, please stop sugarcoating our relinquishment, or not even sugarcoating it, negating it. We are traumatised. We did suffer a trauma. And very often we get a lot of pushback from people, very often adoptive parents actually, who say, no, it doesn't. It isn't trauma. You can't possibly remember. You are only a baby. Stop being bitter and angry. But you would agree with us, wouldn't you? Then, and you say that there's science sort of backs us up. Adoption creates, or rather relinquishment creates, trauma on a limbic level.
Yes, indeed. And limbic is the key word. Limbic is emotional brain. Emotional brain is working from the beginning. Recall comes from more from a rational brain that doesn't come online until a little bit later. There are lots of experiments that have been done. I think I may well have talked about it in that talk that you came to. There were experiments with mothers reading The Cat in the Hat in the third trimester out loud, and later on babies hearing The Cat in the Hat read by mother and indeed other people reading it, and babies showing a preference for The Cat in the Hat read by mother rather than anybody else. And people say, well, how do you know? And what we know, the experiments very serious mainstream, you know, med school experiments, you know, university experiments, and they were monitoring respiratory responses, head turning, sucking responses in babies. And nobody's, you know, no one's no one's really challenging that. It just can't really be challenged. So we know, you know, this bonding, this memory, we know babies can show a preference with head turning for mother's breast milk on a pad of 10 different breast milks after a second day. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? We're geared up to be with the person that we have gestated with. Yeah. And indeed, you know, if you said to most mothers, we're going to take your baby away, they would fight hard. There's a very strong bond for that.
Yeah.
So I have no doubt that that's an enormous shock for a baby. What interests me and the reason I've come into all of this is because adoptees being overrepresented, not just in addiction, but in mental health in general. Yeah. So we have to say, why might that be? I don't think it was because of the signing of an adoption paper. That's for sure. I think it's something to do with, and the fact that they show up is with a hunger for attachment and with a love addiction and the difficulties that really get to them that feel so life-threatening for them, that hijack their emotional brains, are relational.
Yeah, it would be a phenomenal coincidence if there was absolutely no causal link between those two situations. You talk about the pre-verbal. That's what really struck me all those years ago when you said, and it felt like a bolt out of the blue, actually, there is a pre-verbal communication, essentially, that happens, or a pre-verbal. You described it as there's no existence prior to the trauma, essentially.
Yes, I mean, that's it. We talk about, we said there's no trauma personality.
Right. Yeah.
So there are two types of trauma. There's the sort of single event trauma, but that might include being in a war zone, which is obviously a bit more than a single event, you know, an assault, an accident, witnessing something terrible happening, and from which many people we'll go on and get a post-traumatic stress disorder. The sort of traumas that we're talking about are called complex PTSD. We had hoped they would be called developmental PTSD because that would put them more in a context, actually. Now, the difference between the two, if you have an adult or even a late adolescence trauma, something awful happens to you and your functioning has changed, you will remember a time in which your functioning was okay. And you'll think, gosh, something awful's happened. I've been really disabled by this experience. I could once do this, like get in a car if you had a terrible car accident, or walk in a certain place if you'd been assaulted. Once upon a time, I could do this and it wasn't an issue. The problem with these early traumas is there's no pre-trauma personality, no sense that life was ever sort of okay before. So what starts to happen is that actually people, they end up mistaking the trauma personality for their own personality. So people really think there's nothing to fall back on that they can recall. And so actually they feel that actually this is my personality. I am nonsense. I'm defective. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Relating to all of that. Once we accept then that adoption or relinquishment creates the trauma, what then is the causal link between that and then adoptees being overrepresented in rehab facilities and addiction counselling? I had a brother, my late brother, who was also adopted, died a drug addict and alcoholic. Here am I, and it speaks so much to that nature nurture conversation. But where do we go from, okay, little Sarah Jane or Caroline, as I was born, was given up at 6 weeks, at 6 weeks old. 27 years later, she's flying to South Africa to go to addiction treatment for, I mean, the number of 12-step programs, I mean, is endless. I mean, if I listed them all, Paul, we wouldn't have time for the rest of the conversation. So, you know, I am textbook in that regard.
Well, first of all, what you need to know is that addiction, of course, it's often referred to as a primary illness on the basis that if you don't deal with that, you're not going to deal with anything else. Yeah. You know, you need to be in recovery. But it is also a symptom. There's overwhelming evidence that it is a symptom of trauma. The difference between a stressful situation and a trauma is relationship. People who have stress, and children can endure all sorts of things if there's other people around them to say, look, we're in it together, we love you, this shouldn't happen, you know, this is happening. So what we have, first of all, we have this, I believe, enormous trauma at the beginning of life. a trauma that can't be recalled, a trauma that doesn't have pre-trauma personality. So people tend to think that they are the disability, if you like, psychologically, that they feel, that somehow that's them and their personality. But we also have, because of the cover-up, we don't have the attachments, the relationships to make that stress, to keep it as stress and process it. So it's a bit like maths. Stress without attachments equals trauma.
Yeah.
And I think that historically there's been, because of the cover up and the assumption that actually, you know, that you're fortunate to be adopted. I mean, how many other traumas, you know, there are only two, and this is the main one that I know of, where actually you're not only traumatized, but you're supposed to be grateful.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a conversation that, you know, I don't want to get into the politics of adoption because that's not your that's not our conversation. But the number of adoptee groups in that I am in where we talk about, you know, the added then almost the re-traumatization of being gaslit very often, that our experiences are negated, that we're told we're meant to be grateful. I love how you talk about, and I wrote about this in my book, is the impossible job of adoptees, particularly in a case of perhaps where there's been infertility and that infertility by a set of parents hasn't been processed. There's then another wound over there, isn't there? And then you're brought in as the adoptee who, ultimately, if we're going to be cut and thrust about it, is the second best option. And you're kind of brought in to live up to this unrealistic expectation that you'll never live up to because you'll never be that person's biological child. It doesn't mean they don't love you, but it's a very different thing to particularly where, and I think particularly when I was adopted in 1980, there wasn't a great deal of support for my mother who'd struggled with infertility around process that before you welcome a child into your home and your life. Process your grief and your wound around that, because it's likely to then impact on you and her and them and et al. Et
al. Great. Okay, well, Sarah Jane, you just done a really good job of answering the question. However, I think it is an impossible job description. I think the difficulty is because not only is adoption a cover-up for relinquishment, although I wonder a bit now whether relinquishment is the right word, because there's so many with forced adoptions and all of that, but that maybe is a political issue. But also, you're absolutely right, the adoption is also a cover-up for grief. Let's try and replace something that we've either had and lost or wanted and weren't able to have without feeling the grief.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're going to cover up the grief, you need to cover up the relinquishment, if you like.
Yeah.
So it's an impossible job description to come into a family, to solve a problem, to be a person that you could never be, which is the biological child.
Yeah, exactly.
In a setting in which the grief isn't really talked about. And if the grief and the loss can't be talked about for the parents, so parents adopt because they can't live without having a child, mostly, then actually there won't be space to talk about the grief, the relinquishment and what it meant. And it's not just a psychological trauma, but I mean, you'll be aware, you know, ancestry sites and genetic testing, it's very popular. You know, human beings really want to know where they came from. And so transracial adoptions, you know, they've got not only all the stresses of different, you know, smells and sounds, but it's also about sort of roots. Sometimes it's about, you know, original names. It's about, you know, community, you know, the whole who am I that gets actually, again, forgotten, and as if life begins on the adoption certificate.
Lots of people, when they are told about the stats, the statistics relating to adoptees, that we are four times more likely to attempt suicide. We are, as we're talking about now, overrepresented in treatment centres. We're also overrepresented in jail. We're overrepresented in psychiatric facilities. A lot of people who aren't adopted or who don't have an interest in adoption are surprised to hear those statistics. I imagine you're not terribly surprised to hear them at all.
Well, I mean, to be honest, originally I think I was a bit surprised.
Right.
And I'm afraid I was, because I'm not adopted and I don't have adoption close to me. I think I said possibly in that talk, I once went out with a girl who was adopted, and I'm embarrassed to say I thought she made a bit too much of it.
Yeah.
And I can't stop apologising for that. So I sort of understand, because we go along with all sorts of things that, gosh, people go along with and later think about, gosh, that's not right. You know, I think that the tide is turning, and children that are adopted now at least come with sort of backstories, and often sort of in certain places, sort of books and things to describe and information like adoption packs. But nevertheless, it doesn't stop it being really traumatic. And actually, of course, a transracial adoption to a great extent, you know, it could be described as trafficking.
Yeah, and is in a lot of adoption circles. You know, we've been arguing as adoptees that it's the denial of the impact of the relinquishment, the wound that we're talking about, that causes so much of our distress in addition. Because the narrative around adoption so often, as we've discussed now, is it's meant to be great. You know, we talk about it being rainbows and unicorns. We hear a lot of things of, you were a gift, we wanted you so much, your biological mother must have really loved you to have made such a difficult choice. But none of these, and you spoke about this at the start of our conversation, none of these are things that acknowledge the before. And I think often from a psychological point of view, again, if you are dealing, I think it probably tends to happen more where adoption has happened as a result of an infertility. You want what you couldn't have, so you try and create it as close to that as possible. The baby arrives and it's new, fresh to you, but it isn't. That isn't what we're looking at at all. So it means that because it's not acknowledged, yes, it's traumatizing, but most crucially, help isn't sought. We're not necessarily seeing younger adoptees. It very often is the case, I guess, and I wonder if it's changing now, but you get to a situation like with me where I was 27 and ended up in treatment. It wasn't that anybody was discussing with me or giving me language that it was okay to feel sad and do you want to talk about this? And let's, let's acknowledging in an age-appropriate way the wound that we're talking about. So unless you acknowledge something, you can't do anything about it, can you?
No, well, that's a really good point. And of course, that's one of the key things about addiction. You can only change what you acknowledge. And people, as sounds like you know, only recover from addiction when they can acknowledge that it is their problem,
yeah.
You know, and not someone else's. But the other difficulty is that if something really important isn't talked about within a group of people, nothing really of importance gets properly processed. So if a grief isn't talked about, it's going to be very hard to talk about any other what happened before adoption for the baby, let alone the fact that that might be a grief. Because very hard to hold on and stuff your own grief down if you're talking to someone else about theirs.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this it's a big conspiracy born, I think, of just lack of lack of support and naivety, I think, to a great extent in society. I mean, we're seeing these children turn up as teenagers, and come puberty, you know, the act outs really start to be there for adoptees. Yeah. And very often it's the adoptive mothers that get it in the neck.
Yep.
Because
if my mother's listening in now, she's going to be nodding.
Well, this is always the story. And I talk to, I talk to young adoptees, and they're full of shame because they just lose it continually with their adoptive mums and can't really get their heads around it, because somewhere they're losing it with the notion of the woman. In their mind, it was the woman who gave them up. Now, actually, of course, invariably, it's not. It's, there's so many mothers who end up relinquishing. It's not to do with them, actually. It's probably far more to do with male society and feelings that we can't have this, or this is how it should be, and denying, the needs and feelings of the birth mother too.
I wanted to ask you about, we spoke earlier about the impact, or what happens when you break that original mother-baby bond. And you told us what happens, and we see it now in rooms like yours and the rooms of recovery. If we accept then that adoption creates trauma, is it then a stretch or not to say that adoptees become trauma bonded to their adoptive families. And just to sort of pick up on the point that I just made, lots of adoptees will say that the inability, sometimes unwillingness by adoptive parents to acknowledge adoption as a trauma is in and of itself traumatic and abusive. Is that a trauma bond? I've been in groups of adoptees where people have actually spoken about how they liken it to Stockholm syndrome in a way.
Well, firstly, I think you're right. I think there's a second trauma when it's not acknowledged.
Yeah.
I'm learning fast, and I'm learning fast from people like you sitting in the rooms, and it's now been hundreds, you know, of adoptees. And I learned from sort of listening and then talking to colleagues about all of this. So, you know, I used to think it was a trauma for sort of three, it had three difficulties. It was a trauma, it couldn't, you know, it could, and it couldn't be remembered or couldn't be recalled, rather. But I think you're absolutely right. There's a second trauma when it's denied. And I think that makes it very hard. Now, people that are traumatized, or indeed just people that, even if you don't want to use the T word, and you know, enormously stressed, end up being hypervigilant. Because if it's happened once, you know, the reason we're top of the food chain is because we've got an emotional brain with a cluster of cells called the amygdala, which is essentially our smoke detector for danger. And our smoke detector for danger is calibrated by experience. That is, you know, those experiences are the architect of that part of the brain. You've had a bad experience and the brain says, don't forget it, it might happen again.
Yeah.
Now, for the child who is remembering but not recalling, the smoke detector is calibrated in such a way that actually, relationally, they are in hypervigilance. And the problem with hypervigilance is that being hypervigilant and being present and relaxed and spontaneous are mutually exclusive. So when you talk to people with these early traumas, but actually also if you talk to people with event traumas later on, what they'll say is, I went to the party, my friends are there, I sort of got through it. Can't really even remember it, it was okay. Whereas the people who don't have these experiences say, God, great party, when are we going to go again? You know, it's surviving, not thriving.
Yeah, that's such a key point. Okay, so now that we have a conversation, now that we have a name for it, now that we have people like you doing work around this issue, how can it be helped first and foremost? How can it be used, first and foremost to help adoptees and then obviously to help their families, parents? Because as you say, there are a lot of very well-meaning adoptive parents who, when it comes to this type of stuff, no offence, guys, or perhaps a little bit of offence, are totally useless and out of their depth. I would counter that step one is acknowledging it. It's painful. It's hard. It can be. You don't want to acknowledge that your child has suffered a trauma that you perhaps won't be able to fix or will never be able to fix or love them through it. You can't love somebody out of addiction. It's not possible. So what do we do with this information? What do we do with this research? How can it best be used to help people like perhaps 12, 13-year-old Sarah Jane, however many years ago that I don't want to mention, that might have really at a point of, there could have been a moment where there could have been an intervention?
Well, we call it by its proper name. Mm. We tell little Sarah Jane that, you know what, this is a thing. You're not the only one. Mm. There's a sense of universality. The same sense of universality that I imagine helped you recover from your addictions. I'm not the only one. This is a thing.
Yeah.
So I think in the talking about it and calling it by its proper name, we give it a chance. Now, the trouble is the human brain starts working before it's built. You know, it's not like your computer that you buy and you turn it on and it's all fully loaded. So actually the foundations of your brain have been built and part, and your smoke detector calibrated around an enormous trauma, which is a separation from the person that you are most dependent upon, and you will never be more dependent upon anybody else in your life. No, your brain registers that as a catastrophe. It is life-threatening, which, by the way, is why the incidence of suicide is so high, actually, for adoptees. They think about suicide nearly always when there's some relational difficulty. And what I would suggest is that thought of suicide is actually a flashback to the feeling that I'm not going to survive as a child. that some sense that without care, I won't survive.
I thought I felt that way, Paul, because I was defunct. I started off by saying that I'd heard you lecture on this topic in London in 2009. I was a couple of years into recovery. A video was made of that lecture, and it has made a huge impact on adoptees around the world. You've really been hailed as a hero, because I think also, Paul, because so often, despite the fact that we really as adoptees are the experts and we are the people most impacted by adoption, our voices are the least heard. And so when somebody such as yourself speaks to us and also on our behalf, really, it was enormous. Your take on the issue, of course, is a clinical one. This is what you do. But what is your take on how it's been received, particularly by people like me?
Enormously touched. You know, we all have a need for attachment and we all have a need to belong. So it's much nicer when somebody, I get a lot of email actually, probably every 2 weeks from someone, I do try and reply, who says, look, I've seen your lecture and thanks very much. And even more so, you know, now, I guess, in days of Zoom, where people think, gosh, there's a chance of having a chat or something. I find it, you know, I find it very validating and motivating. It's a small part, really, of what I do, to be honest. And I never like to miss a chance. So, you know, I had an email from you. I had no idea when you guys got in touch with me that, you know, you'd come to the talk. I love that connection.
Yeah, it's lovely.
But I just feel a responsibility to do a bit of service and to call this by its proper name because of the, you know, the child that you were and the children that will come along, so that we can say, look, there may be other ways. Perhaps we need to fight to keep children in their communities. Mm-hmm. There will be situations where children need to be brought up by others with legal guardianship. Let's not, you know, let's make sure we hold on to heritage, you know, in every way. Let's make sure we talk about it and, you know, and celebrate it, so that we're all, you know, we're in it together, and we minimize something that, because we can't reverse the trauma, but we can stop it getting re-traumatized by cover up and confusion.
I think that is such a beautiful point and such a perfect spot to end on. We can't negate the trauma. The trauma has happened, nor can we love the trauma away, but there are things that we can do. We can prevent the re-traumatization, and you know, as a member of the adoptee community, that is one of the things that we ask for. And I would just finally say, if you are listening in now and you've perhaps seen some of the engagements that go on social media between adoptees, and I know that sometimes we seem very angry, sometimes we are angry because we're in pain, a lot of us still, it's just maybe listen to what's being said, and maybe challenge your own views around what you've believed adoption to be. I think we were sold a bit of a lie. We were sold this, it's a win-win, and that's not necessarily true. In fact, rarely is it a win-win situation. Sometimes it is a necessity, it is something that happens, but we are not blank slates as adoptees when we arrive with our adoptive families. And nor does having conversations like this, and nor does saying I'm in pain, mean that we love our adoptive families any less or that they don't love us. It's not about that. It's about acknowledging who we are, and that actually we existed before there was the adoption, before there was the signing on the dotted line. There was a relinquishment, and there was a wound and a trauma that came with that. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. A little bit more emotional than I'd bargained for, but still, these are the things, these are the conversations I think they're important to have, particularly this National Adoption Month. It's been, as I say, a great pleasure to have you on the show, and thanks for making time for us.
What a pleasure for me too. Thank you.